Let's go. This is the afternoon session of the Portland City Council. Good afternoon, Keelan. Please call the roll.
Good afternoon. Gonzalez.
Here.
Maps.
Here.
Rubio.
Here.
Ryan.
Here.
Wheeler.
I'll turn over to the city attorney to state the rules and decorum.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome to Portland City Council. To testify before council in person or virtually, you must sign up in advance on the council agenda at www.portland.gov/council/agenda. Information on engaging with council can be found on the council clerk's webpage. Individuals may testify for 3 minutes unless the presiding officer states otherwise. Your microphone will be muted when your time is over. Presiding officer preserves order. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If you cause a disruption, a warning will be given. Further disruption will result in ejection from the meeting. Anyone who fails to leave once ejected is subject to arrest for trespass. Additionally, council may take a short recess and reconvene virtually. Your testimony today should address the matter being considered. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. If you are a lobbyist, identify the organization you represent, and virtual testifiers should unmute themselves when the council clerk calls their name. Thank you.
Thank you. Our first item this afternoon, which is one of two, is a report. Keelan, please read item 670.
Accept Portland's Housing Bond Oversight Committee 2023 progress report.
I'd like to hand this over to Deputy City Administrator Oliveira to introduce the report. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Commissioner Gonzalez, Donnie Oliveira for the record. Commissioners, before I dive into the talking points, I want to just take a moment to acknowledge that, you know, oftentimes you all have to deal with some tough conversations about what's going on in the city. And every once in a while, we get to celebrate some success. And this is what this first item is really about, is to highlight the success of the City of Portland, partnerships with community to really bring housing to those that need it most. So with that, I'd first like to start by thanking the Bond Oversight Committee members for the time, effort, and expertise they each bring to the oversight of Portland's housing bond. Passed by voters in 2016, Portland's housing bond committed $258 million to create 1,300 permanently affordable homes for Portlanders in need. PHB has far surpassed that goal by creating 1,859 units. Alongside the Bond Oversight Committee, the Housing Bureau has ensured that bond investments reflect the values of the communities they are intended to serve and support. Today's Bond Oversight Committee report demonstrates that the city is investing the bond funds wisely and expeditiously in the way Portland voters intended. Today, members of the Bond Oversight Committee will present the 2023 progress report for Portland's housing bond. Council will also hear from Our Just Future, owner and developer of the Aurora, a Portland housing bond project, and also from a resident at the Aurora. These stories exemplify the goals, achievements, and true impact of Portland's housing bond. I would now like to introduce Megan Rillo from the Portland Housing Bureau, who will walk us through this presentation today, along with BOC members Todd Struble and Annalise Kohler.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Megan Grillo. I am the Bond Housing Program Coordinator at the Housing Bureau. And I'm joined here today by Bond Oversight Committee members to present the 2023 Bond Progress Report. The Bond Oversight Committee is composed of community members appointed by City Council. Our current members include Chair Todd Struble, Vice Chair Alan Lazo, and at-large members Susan Emmons and Annalisa Curler, with meetings facilitated by Dr. Stephen Holt. These committee members convene quarterly to oversee implementation of Portland's housing bond. The primary areas of their oversight include ensuring adherence to the goals and priorities of the bond policy framework, creating community through public engagement, and financial accountability. And now I am pleased to introduce Todd Struble and Annalisa Curler to present the 2023 Bond Progress Report. And I believe we have slides. There they are.
We do. Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Annalisa Curler. I use she, her pronouns, and I am a member of the Portland Housing Bond Oversight Committee. If you can advance the next slide for me, please. The Bond Oversight Committee is really honored to be here today to talk about the 2023 annual report to Council to really recognize the achievements of the Portland Housing Bond and highlight the commitment of the remaining bond funds and the project openings in 2024 and 2025. As outlined in our report to Council, our committee reviewed progress on three areas of oversight. First was monitoring how bond activities and investments adhere to the goals of the bond policy framework. At our quarterly meetings, we review progress being made on the projects awarded bond funds and the number of units completed or in progress, and the extent to which we are on track to meet our end goals. By keeping close watch over our progress, we have been able to strategize how to invest the remaining funds within the 5 to 7 year implementation timeframe approved by voters. As you can see from the slide, good news all around. We've exceeded all of our goals around production. So as of 2023, all Portland Housing Bond resources have been committed to 15 projects. This represents a little over 1,800 units, which is 143% of the original goal. We have also been able to provide 774 deeply affordable units, which is 129% of the original goal, 399 PSH units, which is 133% of the original goal. And finally, 836 family size units, which is 129% of the original goal. So across the board, we're really proud of this program and the way it has exceeded expectations and our goals. Next slide, please. In addition to closely following progress on our production goals, the committee has also been reviewing where new units are being created. This is to ensure that they are meeting the intent of increasing opportunity, community partnership, and preventing displacement. This is all what is outlined in our framework. As described in our progress report, 83% of the new units constructed or planned for construction are located in high opportunity areas. This means these new homes are located in areas with access to transportation, to jobs, high quality schools, service, and other amenities. 39% of the units purchased, constructed, or planned are located in areas of high risk for gentrification. These areas are where residents are more vulnerable to changing economic conditions due to race, income, education level, age, and housing cost burden. This is our efforts to help prevent displacement in these areas. In addition, 93% of the projects include permanent supportive housing units. Next slide, please. Next up, we want to talk to you about our equity and contracting goals. At a big picture, from big picture perspective, what we see here is that the bond has injected $289 million into the local economy, creating jobs, helping small businesses grow, and also providing opportunities in workforce development. From an equity perspective, the city of Portland set a goal of achieving 20% disadvantaged, minority-owned, woman-owned, emerging small business, and service-disabled veteran, or DMWESB SDV, very long acronym, contracting for all Portland Housing Bond projects. The Portland Housing Bureau set a more ambitious goal of 30%. I'm really pleased to report today that as of December of 2023, the Portland Housing Bond projects were exceeding this goal, achieving 32% DMWESB SDV participation in contracting. This also includes 24% by certified DMWBE firms, exceeding PHB's 14% sub-goal category. In addition, the Portland Housing Bond projects are also achieving the goals of PHB's apprenticeship and workforce diversity programs of a minimum of 20% of labor hours worked on contracts that exceed 300,000. These are worked on by state registered apprentices. Additionally, PHB set aspirational goals that 22% of the total apprentice and journey level hours are worked by BIPOC individuals, and 9% of the apprentice and 6% of journey level hours are worked by women. In 2023, apprentice hours for bond projects represented 20% of the total labor hours worked, with apprentice hours reaching 40% for BIPOC individuals and 14% for women. Journey level hours were over 50% for BIPOC individuals. Next slide, please. Finally, progress has also been made in increasing assets for priority communities outlined in the bond policy framework. This is done through alignment of services with community partners and the homeless system of care. The housing bond relies on partners, many of whom are culturally specific nonprofit community organizations. And these organizations, their work and their impact grew as a result of their involvement in the Portland bond projects. More than 2/3 of the bond projects have our bond funded projects have partnered with culturally specific agencies, including the Native American Rehabilitation Association, the Native American Youth and Family Center, Familias en Acción, and the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organizations to provide supportive services and referrals. Additionally, our supportive housing developers have partnered with clinical mental health and addiction service partners, including Cascadia Behavioral Health Care, Central City Concern, LifeWorks Northwest, and New Narrative. Next slide, and I'll turn it over to Todd.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Todd Struble. I use he, him pronouns, and I serve as the chair of the Bond Oversight Committee. Transparency and collaboration with community partners is among our guiding principles. The Oversight Committee ensures housing stakeholders in Portland communities are kept informed and have opportunities to provide feedback. BOC meetings are open to the public and include time for public testimony. PHB staff attend stakeholder group meetings, such as neighborhood associations and planning and advocacy groups. The committee works closely with PHB staff and project development teams to communicate progress through reports, newsletters, and meetings. We also seek to engage the community to inform the implementation and development of bond projects. Through alignment with homeless service providers, culturally specific agencies, and our other community organizations, we have worked to create housing for communities disproportionately affected by the housing crisis. Communities of color, families, including families with children, immigrant and refugees in intergenerational households, households experiencing homelessness or at imminent risk of experiencing homelessness, and households facing displacement. Next slide, please. As of 2023, we have 11 projects that are providing affordable housing to Portlanders. This data represents Cathedral Village, The Joyce, Hayu Tillicum, Ellington, East Burnside, Crescent Court, and Crescent Court. Demographic data is collected at least annually to track how well bond projects are serving the priority communities outlined in the framework. As you can see, the housing bond is already creating much needed housing for vulnerable populations like children, seniors, and adults with disabilities, and will continue to do so in the remaining 1,200 units not counted here. Next slide, please. The third focus of our report is maintaining fiscal accountability. Reviewing expenditures and ensuring financial accountability is a core responsibility of the Bond Oversight Committee. Bond dollars are spent clearly and separately tracked. As mentioned previously, Portland's Housing Bond committed $258.4 million to create 1,300 permanently affordable homes for Portlanders. As of December 31st, 2023, $211.3 million of bond funds were expended on project acquisitions and projects under construction. Additionally, $50.4 million in bond funds remain committed for the projects awarded through 2023. This total will decrease in 2024 as distributions continue for projects under construction. Total admin expenses was at 5.45% at the end of 2023. There's a 7% set aside for this, and as projects near completion, we will continue to accrue costs and expect it will be close to 7% when all bond projects are complete. We expect to spend the entire admin allocation by the time the bond is fully implemented. A few reasons why this may vary: at any point in time, the calculation is actual payroll expenses over actual bond expenses, including issuance costs. Payroll costs can be lower or higher depending on the timeline of the projects, for example, if there are delays in construction. And this expense also includes the external audit expense as well. Independent auditor Harvey M. Rose and Associates completed a financial audit of the housing bond for the July 1st, 2021 through June 30th, 2022 fiscal year in December 2023 with no findings. Bond funds for future projects are fully allocated and remaining interest and future interest and credits will be used for funding gaps. Expended and committed funds include the 7% program delivery fee, including PHB's administrative costs, and interest and credits will continue to grow as the issued but unused bond funds earn additional interest. Next slide, please. And here we have the projects that are opening in 2023, or that opened in 2023. We have Emmons Place South and North. Emmons Place, 7 in July 2023, and North, 12/23. The Aurora completed in October 2023, and a Manor House, the South completed in June of 2023, and East completed in October of 2023. And then the Joyce completed in June of 2023. Next slide, please. And looking forward, 149 bond units at the Hollywood Hub projected to be completed in 2026. The project has a total of 222 new affordable units, but only 149 are funded by the Portland bond, and the remaining units are funded by the Metro bond. Again, as mentioned previously, the Hazel Yingli is now open, but as depicted in construction in these slides, as this presentation covers progress through the end of the year 2023. And with that, I will pass it back to Megan.
Great, thank you. We would like to conclude our report today with remarks from our partners at Our Just Future, who will be joining us virtually. I'm not sure if Elsa and Brian are.
Megan, we are both on. Yes.
Great. Thank you. From our partners at Our Just Future, whose expertise, partnership, and projects highlight the goals and achievements of the Portland Housing Bond, I would like to introduce Elsa Natal, Director of Affordable Housing, and Brian Shelton Kelly, Director of Real Estate Development at Our Just Future. They will be attending virtually, and they should have slides titled The Aurora. And I will pass it to Elsa and Brian.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Thank you for that introduction. My name is Elsa Tal. I use she, her pronouns. I am the Affordable Housing Director at Our Just Future. I'm here to tell you a little bit more about our wonderful project. The Aurora consists of a total of 93 units of affordable housing for low and extremely low income families and individuals. It is located at the corner of Aurora and Southeast 160th Street in the Glenfair neighborhood. The site was formerly a restaurant, and in 2016, the county provided funding to Our Just Future for the purchase of the building and to rehab it into an emergency shelter. In 2020, Our Just Future began the process of developing the building into permanent affordable housing, and a couple of important information about the amenities of the building. It is in close proximity to several places of worship, including culturally specific markets, coffee shops, and it has good access to public transportation and other amenities. The design approach at the Aurora was to emphasize the quality and to enhance the standard of construction of affordable housing development in our portfolio. Next slide, please. This building was developed in partnership with Eland & Co. as the development consultant, Holst as the architect, Polas as the general contractor, and including several funding partners, including Portland Housing Bureau, Oregon Housing Community Service, Metro Transit Oriented Development Program, as well as capital financing partners, which included PNC and Chase Bank. I will now pass it over to Brian to provide us with more detailed overview of the development process, including some lessons learned and some important sustainable features of the building. Next slide, please.
Thank you, Elsa, and thank you, commissioners, for this opportunity. Again, the Aurora is 93 units. When we set out to develop this project, we wanted to really emphasize the need for units that can accommodate families. So the Aurora does feature 46 units of 2- and 3-bedroom units for those families. We also incorporated 16 permanent supportive housing units within our unit mix to give families that are experiencing homelessness an opportunity to access both housing that's affordable, but also with services that help them be successful in retaining their housing. 31 of the units are available to households making 30% or less of the area median income. And that includes those 16 permanent supportive housing units. And those 16 permanent supportive housing units also have project-based rental assistance vouchers through Home Forward. Our Just Future provides resident services. And then in this building, we're partnering with LifeWorks Northwest for their provisioning of behavioral and mental health services. And the priority communities that we're serving include low-income families, the households and families exiting homelessness, emphasis and focus on families that identify as BIPOC. Next slide, please. So just to review some of the project schedule. Again, this project took us a few years to get going. We started construction in the summer of 2021. This was definitely a COVID era project with everything that brought. But we worked through all of those issues with our wonderful design team and wonderful general contractor. We achieved construction completion and temporary certificate of occupancy in May of last year. We leased up the property through the summer and fall of 2023. And as of the end of 2023, the property was fully leased up and into operations and kind of stabilized occupancy, performing as intended. We're wrapping up the rest of the development and financing work now, and should be fully closed out in the next couple months. Next slide, please. Just wanted to review the financing. As I'm sure everyone is aware, the financing of affordable housing projects requires multiple different sources, multiple different partners, all working together to produce the housing. The Aurora represents a $38.4 million investment into the Glenfair neighborhood. And I think it's important to highlight that in that, you know, this particular neighborhood, like other East Portland neighborhoods, don't see the same level of investment as Central City neighborhoods. So we felt it very important to be able to produce affordable housing where people already live, and housing that will be affordable for the long term to buttress against displacement or future gentrification. You know, this project will be affordable for at least 60 years and provide a community asset and resource for people that live in the eastern parts of Portland. The Portland Housing Bond contributed just under $15 million towards this project, and that allowed us to leverage about $23, $24 million in other project capital sources, including tax credit equity, construction and permanent debt, funds from Oregon Housing and Community Services, Metro's Transit-Oriented Development Program, and then a variety of other sources, renewable and energy efficiency incentives through PGE and the Energy Trust of Oregon, some philanthropic support, and again, the city's system development charge waiver program is very instrumental in getting these projects financed and built. Next slide, please. Some of the achievements we wanted to highlight about the project, we're very happy to report that we did achieve Earth Advantage Platinum certification for our efforts in advancing energy efficiency and importantly, resident comfort in this project. You know, this project came online right as we were all starting to grapple with the increasing heat that we're facing now. And so in this project, we are providing air conditioning units for each household to help mitigate against the warming climate. We're very happy that we met and or exceeded the equitable contracting outcomes set forth, particularly in our workforce diversity goals. And we really attribute this to the important work that Colas Construction did in reaching out to a diverse workforce. Also wanted to note that we were able to partner with several refugee resettlement agencies that were looking for housing that met the needs of their participants, especially larger units. And that was a really useful partnership for us when we were leasing up the project last summer and fall to partner with those agencies to get their participants into secure and safe housing. Next slide, please. Did just want to share some of the challenges we faced in the project. Again, this was a COVID era project. So we did have delays in construction, most notably a electric equipment delay of about 4 months that did impact construction completion and our lease up schedule. Again, we were able to work through that, but I think this project, like many of the projects that were being built in that era, had delays that all development teams had to really be creative and do a lot of work through to get those done. We, as an owner and developer, learned some things in the construction. We always like to do kind of a post-construction reflection and say, you know, what worked, what didn't in both the design and construction phase. We did have some challenges in the lease up. I think one in particular that we want to highlight, and this isn't to blame anyone in particular, but really just point out a system level issue that we think we want to all pay attention to a bit is the PSH, the Permanent Supportive Housing lease up process, did prove to be slow and cumbersome and needed a lot more owner and property management involvement than I think we initially intended. And again, we were able to lease up those 16 PSH units in partnership with the Joint Office and the Coordinated Access System and the service providers. But it took a fair amount of coordination, and I think a lot more than we originally anticipated. Next slide, please. And then we had some other observations that we wanted to share with council and the bond oversight committee. And we really saw this in the lease up, and we really view these as kind of system level and policy level challenges. Wanted to highlight that there are just not enough 30% AMI affordable units, area median income units available, and not enough rental assistance. We found that the unsubsidized 30% AMI units in our property were the most in demand and the first to lease up. And that, I think, really illustrates the lack of units that are affordable for the very lowest of income families and individuals in our community. Very high demand for three-bedroom units at any price point. Again, I think that really illustrates the relative lack of larger sized units for households that need three-bedroom units or above. We did find lower demand for the one-bedroom units that we had priced at the 60% AMI level, and I think we're starting to see that more in the market as that shifts some. And then I think another important thing that we're wanting to highlight and raise up is the rental assistance. Especially the shorter-term rental assistance, does definitely help get people into housing, but we are seeing kind of the unintended consequences that happen when that rental assistance ends after 3 months or 6 months or 12 months. We're really seeing that once that assistance ends, the families and households are unable to pay rent and are starting to build up delinquencies that does put them at risk of eviction or having to exit their housing for that. I think we're really seeing that it takes a good 12 months for the families and households just to get stabilized, let alone to the point where they're finding secure and stable employment that are paying living wage jobs or paying jobs that are paying living wages, excuse me. The risk of eviction or further housing instability can both be new incidents of trauma and set them back in their stability path. We don't have any great answers for that. I think this is something a lot of operators and folks operating in the affordable housing space are seeing, but we did feel it important to highlight to the policymakers. Next slide, please.
Thank you, Brian.
And then Elsa, I'll turn it over to Elsa for just to review some of the demographics of our property.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, just building a little bit upon that. It is important to note an overview of the tenants that are served in this building. We intentionally designed this building to serve the population that is representative of our Just Futures mission and values. This building primarily serves BIPOC households, large low-income families with children, and some low-income seniors. The average household income at the Aurora is approximately $21,000, which is less than the 30% of area median income. This wage amounts to approximately $1,700 per month. Most of our residents are on fixed incomes. They are persons without regular full-time employment. They are gig workers and part-time workers in low-wage service jobs, primarily food delivery drivers and care attendants, that type of positions. As Brian previously mentioned, it is important that to highlight that given our average resident profile, most, if not all, of the residents of the Aurora would benefit from rental assistance, which again would allow for long-term stability and the prevention of rent burden. At the moment, the Aurora benefits from only 16 rental assistance vouchers. Next slide, please.
I think that's...
Oh, is that all
the slides? I think that's the end. Yeah.
Well, happy to take any questions. Again, thank you so much for the opportunity to present to you, and we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Does that conclude the report?
It does not. We have one more presenter. Great. Yeah. Unless you all have questions for Brian and Elsa.
For the group that's here now.
I think Brian and Elsa will stay on so we can do questions at the end with Helmi, the director. Okay, great. I would now like to introduce someone who can offer a unique and important perspective of one of our Portland Bond projects, the Aurora. Charles Bishop is a resident at the Aurora and is going to provide some information for us.
Good afternoon, Council. My name is Charles Bishop, and I am a resident. Me and my children are residents at the Aurora since October of 2023. And how my family came to be present at the Aurora was that I came back from Texas on a temporary visit in April of 2023 to help one of my younger children who was kind of struggling with some dynamics in school. In my absence, he's never not been around me. And it caused a kind of a vacuum that I need to come back and support the mother in. On completion of the school year, we got him kind of up to speed and back into a safe, mentally stable place. The mother of my two middle children passes away abruptly. And to say the least, there was a shift in my whole life dynamic. I was chopping cedar in Central Texas, providing and co-oping on the homestead down there, ready to bring one of my two sons down there. And I had to change that plan abruptly. And so for the first few months after I assumed full custody of my two middle children, after the mother passed away, we were doing the couch surfing thing, the pillar to post, friends and family type of thing, until I was able to establish a foothold on some work. I was driving a school bus for first student for the summer months and then into fall. And then upon that, we had to establish housing, you know, and living in Central Texas, living on 30 acres of land, and then seeing the opportunities here in the city was a big, you know, a paradigm shift. I'm from Portland, but my mind had already shifted to something different. And 160th and Stark was a very big jump for me. I was used to open spaces and fields, wanted a backyard for my kids. So of course I looked over the Aurora many times, but when it comes to providing stable housing and making a move that will benefit your family, there was a relationship that I previously had through church. One of the managers at the Aurora was a friend that I had through church, and she suggested that I come apply, and I did. And I walked in, I did a tour. And when I say that, you know, it was an immediate connection. It was everything that my children needed, everything that, you know, that we hope for in a home. It was just, like I said, location, location. You know, my mind was used to something else, but also I'm now not a single person for myself. It's a family affair. It's the benefit of the family and what are the best needs for them. And it was located next to the schools that they were already attending in the area that they were already accustomed to. So it was a perfect fit. We did the paperwork. And, you know, if you don't know anything about affordable housing paperwork, it's very detailed. It's very not scrutinous, is not to say it's in a bad way, but it's just you got to cross your T's and dot your I's because they want to make sure that, you know, that everything that they need in federal guidelines that and you have match up and it's solid. So we did all that. That was about a couple of weeks of going back and forth. But the management at Aurora made that possible. And they worked with my then employer to help me get in the doors and secure housing for my family. And that in itself was just gratitude because living on your oldest daughter's couch with the younger siblings in a one bedroom. And of course, a younger sibling who I originally came back to Portland for had to come too. So we had to have him there. So that's four people in a one bedroom situation. And granted, there's people that have to do bootstraps and live in all kinds of different conditions. Grateful for every opportunity that we've been through, but having that three bedroom and getting stable housing for my children was so essential. And this is what it created. It created a place for us to now set up and now for my children to grieve, you know, in a secured environment, a safe environment. They're no longer worried about where we're going to sleep today, where we're going to go to tomorrow. There's now stability. I think that once a person can have shelter, food, and basic accommodations, they can start to expand their thought process. And that's what we were allowed to do. They were able to go to school and be successful in school this school year because they had stable housing. Does not mean it did not come without challenge, right? We have all kind of microcosms in the area of the Aurora, not necessarily in the Aurora, but we do have those behavioral dynamics that are both beneficial and both challenging. So the Aurora and the wraparound services that Our Just Future provides are essential. There's an Our Just Future coordinator there 3 days a week. And there's management there every day. So the way it's set up is there's a building management, Cushman and Wake do their thing, rents and administration, but there's a services that are a direct provision to the people that live at the Aurora, whether you're social economic situation is higher, lower, or whatnot, they provide the same baseline services for all residents there and do an impeccable job. It's a team. I've only met one of them, and Ms. Shanice, but I know there's a team behind closed doors that help the different residents at the Aurora. And I think the reason why those wraparound services are very essential is because there's a lot of mental health that has been prevalent in that area. And you can build the building, right? But and you can take the people off the street, but sometimes that street survival mechanism is still prevalent in them. So you gave them shelter, you gave them an elevator, you gave them central air and a secure building, but their mind has to heal, their PTSD and their trauma has to heal, has to change. And we have our daily citizen that's outside from midnight to early morning, yelling all kind of obscenities and stuff like that. Like, right. Like he's going through trauma, obviously. And at first my kids did not understand what was going on. Right. They were like, you know, why don't want this guy to stop? And I said, well, he's not in our situation. He's had an experience like we had. There's a lot of people not in your situation, you know, that are glad they're not in your situation. So my children in their healing process has learned to have a different compassion and resiliency that they probably wouldn't have had if they not had to be in a situation to witness that firsthand. So now you got this thing that's happening, right? We're no longer seeing bad as bad. Maybe it doesn't serve us the best, but we're not seeing bad as bad. We're seeing a human condition happen. And that's what's happening around the Aurora and in the surrounding area. We're doing our best to provide services and accommodations that will help us solve a more bigger problem that came well before the Aurora was ever built or even thought of, you know? So those wraparound services are And that partnership is one half. You got the building, that's another portion. And just like your funders and developers and architects, you need a whole team to make the whole thing happen on every level, right? On every level. I'm single. I'm a dad that's doing it by myself, but I have a village. I have a partnership and a coalition to help me with these children in the school, in the community. There are surrounding churches that the kids love to attend. And so with that, I'm very grateful every time I walk into my home with the yelling, with the broken down elevator at times, because I understand that that's not the building itself. It's the human condition. And so we've learned to give that grace. We learned to give understanding. We learned to evolve our own thought process. And we would not have ever experienced that if the Aurora wasn't available, right? So there's a more of a nugget than a negative going on. This just shows that there's just more work to do. You know, there's just more work to do. The funding is essential. And even though my aspect is my aspect, it comes from a place of I had to suffer, I had to go through, I had to see. And so with that, I'm able to send that message down to my neighbors because they're part of my village too. That guy yelling, that guy going through his traumatic experience, those people that come with the PTSD of being in the streets are part of my children's village too. So we may not be able to bring everybody into our house and feed them. We may not be able to, you know, befriend them as a close family member, but we see them differently because we understand that they're part of this. They live in the same building I am, right? So we're having this experience together. We got to make it right. And if it wasn't there, you know, and if the resources weren't there, I think that we will find more people and there will be more expanded issues that would be on the streets plaguing more people. Right now, we have less people in the streets that are seeing hope, that are seeing an opportunity, that are now changing their mindset because where there was no way, there is a way now. And the Aurora, our just future, these dollars that you guys sign off on are providing that. And I just want to say thank you and we're grateful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Charles.
Yeah.
Wise words about human experience.
Yeah.
All right. And now I wanted to pass it off to Helmi Hisrick, the director of the Portland Housing Bureau, for some closing remarks and questions.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience and for allowing us this opportunity to share this with you. For the record, Helmi Hisrick, director of the Portland Housing Bureau. I use she, her pronouns. I want to take a minute to express my thanks to the Bond Oversight Committee members, Annalisa Kohler and Todd Struble, who have been who presented today and have been part of the oversight of this bond for several years. Thank our partners from Our Just Future and Mr. Bishop for his fantastic remarks, and also to Megan Grillo, who is our bond coordinator and has put this presentation together and has been instrumental in a clear public explanation of the bond program. I also want to take a minute to thank the Portland City Council, in particular extend my gratitude to Commissioner Rubio, Commissioner Ryan, and Mayor Wheeler, who have overseen the Housing Bureau over the past several years as we have implemented the Portland Housing Bond. And I also want to acknowledge the staff of the Portland Housing Bureau and the prior directors whose excellent administration and implementation of this housing bond has resulted in really strong results. Not only has this bond exceeded all major production goals, but each of these homes is mandated to be affordable for 99 years. And that's a very important thing and somewhat unique or exceptional for the city of Portland. You may or may not know, but the federal low-income housing tax credit mandates 30 years of affordability. Not every local jurisdiction has the courage to require 99 years, but Portland adopted this policy, and these bond funds will create permanent affordability or 99 years worth of affordability for all the homes that are built. By exceeding the production targets and by extending the affordability period, this has created a multiplier effect for this generational investment, creating a highly effective investment of taxpayer funds. For approximately $40 for a year for 22 years, which is the average cost to the Portland homeowner, we are creating 1,859 permanently affordable homes, or homes that will be affordable for almost for a century, for 99 years. This is largely thanks to our partners, the developers, the builders, the property managers, and the service partners who ensure that these projects will be a vital component to a livable city. The future of Portland depends upon the continued investment in affordable housing, And through Portland's housing bond, we have demonstrated that we can steward significant public investment in affordable housing to achieve measurable outcomes that will last for decades to come. Thank you. Oh, I do want to mention that we also have a printed bond report, which we will make sure all of you have.
Thank you. Does that conclude the report?
Yes, it does. Thank you. Thank you.
Keelan, it looks like we have at least one sign up for public testimony.
That's correct.
We can make just a little bit of space here.
Yeah. Bridge Crane, Simca Johnson.
Good afternoon, Mr. President of the Council and other mayor commissioners. Where to start? It's maybe not the best choice, but let's start with Oregon Live, the website of the Oregonian. Portland paid its housing director $88,000 to leave. Of course, this is two housing directors ago, or one permanent housing director ago, before Molly Rogers was interim director of housing.
Could I pause you 1 second? Is this germane to the matter before us?
I believe we've got the, we're talking about how the housing bond, which is covered in this eight-page printout, us mere peons that live on the street don't get a preview of the slides that come with this presentation.
I'll let it go. I can be a stickler on this.
You could convene remotely, or you can allow me to talk for the remainder of 3 minutes.
Please keep going.
Thank you. This presentation, in spite of the fact that the public, every taxpayer in Portland, was deprived of those slides because the electronic presentation on the city agenda only made this different presentation available. But in a way, that was an excellent thing because the slide presentation goes above and beyond. On the page here, where it talks about how well we did over, it's like 559 units above the goal. And on this little jihad here, there's only a check mark, but the excellent presenters provided us with a slide that gave us percentage. Every category over 120%, we've exceeded what the taxpayers needed. And it's good to pat ourselves on the back sometimes, but there's no contextualization of these numbers. What has been the situation with homelessness since the voters passed this in 2017? I don't think anybody in here could say it's gotten better. It was supreme that our Just Future Coalition went with Mr. Bishop, who could honestly relate that right outside the doorway of his what he's benevolently been blessed with at the Aurora. There's a person who's underserved, partially because we didn't have a matching investment in community mental health. There's probably not going to be a sobering center until 2026. So it's good, very good. The Bond Oversight Committee, at only four people. I'm so glad that we did that with just Mr. Struble, Alan Lazo, Susan Emmons, I'm not sure if that's related to Stuart Emmons or not, and Annalise. And I don't want to be totally, I don't think I've been totally negative, but in addition, Portland is not hemorrhaging people, but we are losing people. So as population declines, housing should get better, right? As people go away, there are vacant houses, homes, apartments, whichever. So we can have some look at when we're dealing with, and of course this bond measure inspired Metro to pull off another miracle, and so we'll see if they can exceed the dollar value that you had done excellently here. I think in closing, as you all are familiar with, we often talk about 300 or 400 slot seed projects for new home ownership. So I hope that the management that Mr. Bishop is getting will help his family go even beyond the blessing of the Aurora as we partner them to improve home ownership ratios for
communities that are doing so much. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Any other public testimony?
That completes testimony.
Colleagues, any question or comments?
Oh yeah, sure. I just want to start off by saying thank you. That was a great report. The volunteer network is vast, and it's also just really good to see the data being so clean and clear. And let's see, I want to figure out how to do this. Actually, could you please come back up? Mark Bishop, is that your name? Charles Bishop, could you come back up to the table? And why Mr. Bishop's coming up, I try and remember if this was how relevant this was, but when I had the brief time overseeing the Housing Bureau, I remember we thought there was a big leap from 30% to 60% in AMI. And there was conversations about 40 to 45%. Like that's like the missing number in between for workforce housing. COVID really exposed how many of our essential workers didn't live in Portland, and yet they were the ones that we needed to come to in-person work. And so there was some talk that the 40, 45% would help us with that. And then as I recall, well, hang on, this isn't for you, you'll have another dialogue.
I'm learning.
There was talk about this was a Salem issue, that there was something that we'd have to do down in Salem. Has there been any more conversations about that?
About the AMI levels?
Yeah.
There's a lot of conversations taking place. I think the bond implementation was done using very traditional tax credit financing methodology.
I appreciate that you said traditional, right?
Yeah, the way it's often done in most jurisdictions. And I think the look back, we will be taking a look back at all the housing that's been produced and seeing if it's actually meeting the needs of Portlanders. And our current the current conversation is that we probably need to look at deeper affordability in many of our units.
Yeah. So I wasn't just missing the 0 to 30%. It was more that once we got above 60, it was not as a big a need. And there was like this gap between 30 and 60 that we needed to look at. And I was always told that was an issue we'd have to take up in Salem. So maybe we can have dialogue about our legislative agenda. And I'm sure this is already in conversations amongst all of you. And Commissioner Rubio has been doing a great job with this. And I haven't had a chance to speak with her prior to this presentation, but I wanted to acknowledge that. When I had the assignment, I'll never forget these situations. I would call the provider, say, Our Just Future, and let them know they were aborted. And over half the time, I would get this feedback that we really have some concerns. And it kind of got to what you were talking about, Mr. Bishop, that we need some extra, we have workforce challenges. Everyone has workforce challenges, but theirs was around safety. And they were having challenges with getting people to take the job and stay in the job in the evenings and such. And they felt like they were all alone sometimes. And this was back when 911 wait times were much longer than they are now, but it was pretty scary to listen to those stories. And they, of course, wanted to be a part of the team. They were going to accept the award. They were enthusiastic about it. They really wanted me to hear that. And when I was listening to you, it reminded me of those phone calls. And I remember when I was building the Safe Rest Villages, I would hear, especially from women, that they didn't feel safe in some of the affordable housing they had lived in the past, because the person that was that was causing them harm was in the same hallway. And when they were out in the streets, they sometimes felt like they had easier escape patches, if you will. And I know I'm being really vulnerable and explaining like some of the real issues that we have out there, and this is hard. But my point is, they said basically they needed more staffing for both wraparound services and for just basic safety and security.
Right.
And when I listened to you, Mr. Bishop, it reminded me of those conversations. So this is your chance to just give us some more feedback on what you hope as we move forward, building affordable housing that makes it safe for you and your children.
You did address the fact that the conversations have been happening before the Aurora in different projects. So, and that same dynamic, you know, is prevalent, but it's also, again, we brought a thing into the Aurora, you know, building it itself was very important, but there's still experiences, you know, lifetime experiences happening there at the same time. The manager is wearing multiple, the property manager is wearing multiple hats to make sure the building can be as safe as possible, but that's really a team effort. A lot of things that happen after they're gone. Right. So that conversation that you're talking about, you know, there's a real case for it. You know, we can use some more protocols in place to secure the building even more. I don't know what conversation, you know, and what stage it is in right now. It has been brought up by the management to have security there at night. Neighbors look out for neighbors, though. We still have some, you know, kind of community, even though we're in a building and we're in a kind of an incubator, it's still a community, though. There's kids there. My kids play with other kids there.
No, you're part of the solution by being in that building.
It's about having the conversation. Yeah, and the solution is really about having the conversation. And the people that you wouldn't think want to be a part of the conversation absolutely want the same thing that everybody does. I know that my family will one day be able to move on and exit from the Aurora and allow another family that is in transition like I was to be able to have the opportunity, because that's the whole goal, right? Even though we have PSH in place, you want people to be as self-sustainable as possible.
Independence to independence.
Yes. And until then, there is a ongoing dynamic, but not all of it is negative. It's just that you may have the same people that are bringing in their old behaviors into a new situation. And either their support is maybe this is not the best place for you, because this is a place for families and community that want to thrive and live together, no matter what your condition was, how you got here.
Yeah.
But also that the conversation that, you know, security and other protocols in place would be a valuable asset to maintaining community safety.
I like what you're saying in that it's about the community solution. It starts within the building. And so the more that you engage residents that live there like yourself
100%
with the management team, then that's part of the solution.
Yeah.
And your friends and the partners at Our Just Future, they're part of helping set that table for that type of dialogue.
Right. And you can never know. And even when the last screw was drilled in and the doors were hung, you'll never know what's going to happen until you have that living experience. So now that we're a year down the road after completion of the building, and the building is almost full of families, you now know, okay, let's reevaluate. This is the time to say, what can we do better, you know, going into year two, three, and beyond, right? So, like, you have people on the wait list ready to get in for the opportunity. You have people that, like, I had a neighbor who was AA. And for her, the outside element was not safe for her and her sobriety. So she did have to move her family. It wasn't an issue.
AA, it was Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes, okay. Yes. She was 3 years clean and sober.
Right.
And there was just kind of a refueling of old environment for her.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that's a bad move for her. It just means that she's making the best move to keep her family safe.
Right.
There's people that love it there, right? Are thriving there. We have refugees, we have immigrants, we have people that are from all walks of life there. So they see it as a step up in their situation that might not have been available unless Aurora was there and other housing projects like that. It's just a matter of really now let's kind of like rehone what we do here and how we do it. You know, it's not management's job or our just future's job, you know, to figure out the whole thing. Like, come talk to residents. The management, Shanice and Drea, the people there that, like, Drea's part of Cushman Wake and Shanice is part of Our Just Future. They have ongoing conversations with us. They knew that there were hungry children there. They provided a summer lunch program, right? They've opened the doors for many things to happen there. And these are just the small things that they do to help expand services there and make sure that the community is getting their needs met as best possible. I know they won't hit every nail on the head, but that's where the partnerships come from. That's where the conversations
expand
to those who can.
And it sounds like you've helped create that type of a culture in your dialogue with management team and with the partners at Our Just Future.
Only because we're there in it with our neighbors, right? So sometimes it might not be a thing to directly impact my family specifically, but it is one of our community members that do need that service or that help. And just having that conversation, understanding that we've all been there. Like I said before Aurora, I was pillar to post. After Aurora, I'm able to, you know, have a different conversation and maybe help someone else too. You know, I've been helped by others there. We've established great relationships with each other there. You know, like I said, it's a wonderful place to live. It does have its thing, right? It has an element, and that element has to probably be a team conversation that happens over time to solve it. But it's a great place to live.
And it's great to hear your children stay in the same schools district and that consistency.
Absolutely. That consistency was very beneficial for their, you know, in the morning.
Hopefully that's part of the weighted formula on choosing families.
Okay. Yeah.
Great. I think it was just important to do some more dialogue about this, because it's been a concurrent theme of dialogue. So I think my question would be, I don't know what we build it and then there's the management of it. And I know that that's always challenging and who's now on first after the construction's done and the operations continue. Do we at the Portland Housing Bureau set up the learning communities so that the RGIS Futures and other peers can talk about these relevant issues that are probably taking place at many of the affordable housing complexes that we're building? Or whose responsibility would be to tackle that?
So we do monitor housing over the entire period of affordability. I don't believe we have learning communities, but the affordable housing community is in fact a community of professionals who talk to each other, and there are many different forums for us to engage in those dialogues, often through sort of statewide convenings and even local convenings. So we're in the conversation, but not specifically.
And have we set up metrics that look at the retention of housing, the going from dependents to independents, children that are in the units, if they're continuing to succeed in school? I can't help myself. So I'm just wondering those type of North Star guidelines and metrics that we're looking at. It's one thing to build it, but then it's like, how is this becoming successful for the long term?
Yeah, we definitely manage the quality. We do manage quality. We have a process for making sure that the affordable housing remains affordable, that households are doing well. We have helplines for folks if they're in distress. And then often what will happen is if there's, I'll just say, I don't believe we have a specific monitoring that you're describing to make sure that we're tracking every family. We don't have the capacity for that, but we have mechanisms to make sure that if we're hearing that there's distress within a community, that we're responding to that.
And I think it gets at some of our dialogue we're having with the joint office on the Joint Office for Homeless Services. It's one thing when someone leaves a Safe Rest Village into housing. What really matters is that 3 years later, they're still in housing. They're still stable. They're hopefully, if they were addicted to various things, they're now sober and they're in employment. And so I think government has to take a stronger position on how we measure the outcomes going forward. Just like when I was involved in the education space, it didn't matter how many people enrolled at PSU. It mattered how many people actually got a degree from PSU. Otherwise, they just went into bad debt. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, I kind of think about housing that way as well, that we want to see families like yours. We want to see your children, of course, graduate from high school and go much further. We want to see that you will go from dependence to independence. So I think as long as I'm on this council, I want to keep asking those questions so we can start to have those community-wide benchmarks that allow us to see the return on this investment really is something that voters will continue to get behind, and then we'll see more investment from the voters because they'll see those long-term results.
If you don't mind,
please.
Part of your constituency, your voters, you know, maybe not district by district, but just all citywide, live in that apartment complex, right?
Yes.
So in order for them to feel a part of the process, they have to be brought into the conversation.
Always.
You know, so the metrics is way above, and this is not like a intellectual insult. It's just like, they're not thinking about that.
Of course not.
They're thinking about day-to-day peace, harmony, elevator working, you know, clean environment, stuff like that. Like that's just day to day. So when we have the metrics conversation, you know, if you break it down to the people that are living there, it has to be in a sense of what can we do better for you, which will lend itself to a bigger and better living space and environment. And then from that conversation of that bigger lens, we can start to say, okay, on the ground level, where it really matters, because you're a numbers guy, right? From your experience,
I'm at an elevation where I have to look at information.
Of course, you see it differently.
Your scope, decisions, right?
Mm-hmm. I've been that, and I'm also in this real time situation. And right. from that lens, like that won't matter if people are starting to exit and rather go live with a family member or feel unsafe, and you got a bunch of 911 calls and stuff like that. Like we need like the conversation. Yes, government take a stronger stance, but also you have all these organizations, all these partnerships out in the community that are providing great work and great services. So government could have those conversations with those partners, right?
You have to do it all, don't you think? Like, you have to look at the practices that actually allow people to want to stay there. And that
I'm not disagreeing with that. I think practices are essential. I think that what happens is that we get burnt out and we get overworked, the same group doing the same thing. And you have a lot of nonprofits out there doing a lot of good work, right? That are actual frontline boots on the ground. And they need this energy, like they need this conversation, maybe not directly from you, but they need to have the conversation with our Just Future, with the SEIs, with the Portland Housing Bureau,
yes,
to say, how can we just do our thing on the ground level better? Because ultimately that leads to the numbers that you want, that leads to the livability in the community that you do want. It benefits you, it benefits the community. So developing those relationships, oversight has to have, you know, kind of a multi-approach, right?
Yeah.
We have to have that relationship capacity. And these people that are living on the front line, day-to-day life, need to be a part of the conversation, because oversight can't really see the vision clear unless you have all aspects dialed in. So
yeah, no, you have to have the relationships on the ground 100%. To have any merit in this.
100%. And they can tell you.
I don't get a lot of opportunities to have a person come to this dais to speak to us with such authenticity about the experience. Right. So it's really helpful.
And maybe I'll have a neighbor that will have a different conversation.
What's that?
Maybe one of my neighbors will have a different perspective, right?
Yes.
From their lens.
Yeah.
But you collect all that information, you're able to make the best.
That's why it's getting at the learning community. So if the Our Just Futures and the SEIs are meeting together frequently, having facilitated dialogues about this conversation that includes, most importantly, input from the ground.
Absolutely.
And I think as Portland moves forward beyond the building and into the sustainability, because I heard 99 years, which is phenomenal.
That is.
How do we make that count? In 5 years from now, what does that look like?
Yes,
in 10 years, what does that look like?
Definitely.
And so I think when we have an opportunity to have someone like you come here, it just gives us, give someone that's curious, and you shouldn't run for office unless you're incredibly curious,
right,
to have these kind of conversations. So absolutely. I really do appreciate it. One last thing. Do you think the workforce opportunities are available in terms of the services at the housing complex? And is that part of one of the practices that you hear about very frequently?
I think work source, food, and even, you know, just becoming clean and sober are all resources that are available in that area. And even at the building, I think that a person.
So it is accessible.
It is accessible. I think that a person has to be willing to reach up and get it. You know, you can put out a buffet, but if all they want to eat is spam, you know, then they're not going to eat any of the good things you prepared for them. They have to want it really bad enough. And there's a lot of families that do want it, right? So they'll come to Shanice or even Drea if, you know, they need to, and look for resources, and they'll go above and beyond. If Our Just Future doesn't have it built in-house, they'll go above and beyond to find that resource. Like, they're really good people working there. I think that just resources and connecting them to the people are the main dynamic that need to happen.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. That might not be necessarily more money. It just means just over time building the relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Charles, thank you so much for being here today and for being so open and candid. It really helps us as policymakers.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions, comments, discussions from my colleagues?
No. I move to accept the report, though.
Can I get a second?
Second.
Oh, sure, a second.
So that was a move by Commissioner Mapps, a second from Commissioner Rubio. Keelan, please call the roll.
Mapps.
I want to thank Commissioner Rubio for her work in this space. I want to thank the Housing Bureau and the Housing Bond Oversight Committee. It has been a remarkable experience to watch this particular program unfold over time. I think it's an unambiguous success, and I sure hope it'll be a model for bringing affordable housing to the Portland metro area moving forward, which is one of the many reasons I am glad to vote to accept this report.
Rubio.
I'd like to thank the committee members for their time and expertise that they bring to the oversight of this really important work and making sure that the bond is used in the way that Portland voters intended. It's been an incredible success. It's been 7 years since we asked voters to invest in this first housing bond ever. And They've done an excellent job at the Bureau exceeding the goals. And 40% more than what we said that we were going to do. That's incredibly just so compelling and an impressive track record. So I'm also deeply appreciative of the continued focus to ensure these investments center racial equity from construction to providers to housing residents, and also encouraged about how many of these buildings are including permanent supportive housing. I also want to appreciate the comments about the project challenges, because that too is really important for us to review lessons learned so that we're continually improving our systems, especially when we're when the system is so dependent on multiple partners. So we're eagerly looking for the next set of buildings to cross the finish line that connected to the bond. And I just want to say thank you so much to the excellent Housing Bureau team, committee members, and partners for this exceptional work. Congratulations. I vote aye.
Ryan.
Yeah. First of all, thank you, staff. It was really a great presentation. And it's great that we went well beyond our goals. I think when I was there, I was like, well, hey, maybe our goals weren't high enough, but we get to learn from that. My point is, we're at a place where we get to do some study on what's working, what's not, and then what success looks like after someone moves in. And I just think we need to continue to ask. Clearly, I think it's important to ask those through line questions. I think that that's what people are desiring. They want to see that when someone moves in, that they have a stable life, and it's for the long term. And as we continue to try to build more transition housing, which is really what the Cypress Villages were always about, is to make sure that we do the proper assessment. So when we move people into housing, you have more information on who's moving into the housing. And so they have more insight into how to provide those services. So I hope that between the city and the county, we're constantly working on the information that will be helpful for our providers so that we can continue to be successful, with hope that we'll continue to be open to learning, and that we can celebrate this step of success with a lot of curiosity and ambition to continue to improve. I vote aye.
Gonzalez.
I vote aye. The report is accepted. Keelan, item 671, please.
Streamline and update the land division regulations and other related code provisions.
I'd like to hand it back over to Deputy Oliveira to introduce this ordinance.
Thank you, Commissioner Gonzalez, Donnie Oliveira for the record. Council, I'm happy to introduce this ordinance for the land division code update. This is a zoning code project. It's recommended by the Planning Commission to you all. The proposed zoning code amendments encourage new housing development, streamline and speed up the residential land division review process, and reduce regulatory barriers and uncertainty while providing beneficial outcomes for the community. These changes are especially useful for smaller residential sites, which represent most land division applications. Some of these changes remove ambiguities from the code, providing greater certainty for both applicants and neighbors. Other changes will result in lower direct costs to applicants, which in turn helps improve the feasibilities of developments. This is particularly important today when we face a housing emergency and are doing everything we can to increase housing production. The code amendment is brought to you by Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I'd like to invite BPS's Interim Director, Eric Engstrom, to introduce his project team. Thank you.
Thank you again for the record. This is Eric Engstrom, director at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I want to just start off by mentioning that the land division process is inherently really a multidisciplinary process. It involves a lot of professionals from a lot of different disciplines, including utility experts, environmental professionals, attorneys, forestry. And so with that in mind, I just want to acknowledge that we had a lot of input from several different bureaus in this process, including PP&D, BES, PBOT, Water, Parks, Urban Forestry, and the City Attorney. And with that, I'll pass it on to the project team, which is Principal Planner Sandra Wood and Senior Planner Morgan Tracy.
Great. Thank you so much, Director Engstrom. Good afternoon, Commissioners and City Administrator, I think. My name is Sandra Wood. She, her. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a principal planner and manager of the code development team. And with me is Morgan Tracy, senior planner. We're here to present the Planning Commission's recommendation on the land division code update. We're going to switch our order around a little bit. We have our commission chair available to give a few remarks before we begin. She has some time constraints. So I see Mary Rain O'Mara is on the line.
Thank you so much, Sandra, and good afternoon, commissioners. Thank you for changing the order here so that I could get my recommendation relayed to you all this afternoon. So again, my name is Mary Rain O'Mara. I am the chair of the City of Portland Planning Commission, and I'm really pleased to offer our recommendation today to City Council to adopt the Land Division Code Update Draft Report, appeal the zoning code, and repeal the 2002 potential landslide hazard map. This project, the Land Division Code, came before the Planning Commission on March 26th and April 23rd. We had two meetings with agenda time dedicated to this project. After holding a public hearing and reviewing the written testimony, the Commission voted unanimously to recommend approval of the Land Division Code update project to you before City Council. If approved, these changes to code will remove barriers to housing production by simplifying the land division process for small residential development. That will add to the city's housing stock of new homes, including duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes. This smaller scale infill development is a crucial tool to addressing the city's need for new housing units over the next 20 years, as demonstrated by the housing needs analysis. Given that these regulations had not been updated since 2002, it was overdue to revisit the efficiency of this process and make improvements that can help streamline development for residential property owners. As part of this process, the Planning Commission really does want to recognize the tremendous amount of work and outreach conducted by BPS staff that was involved with the updates to the landslide hazard map, which I'm sure staff will speak to in their presentation. We learned that staff received outreach and testimony from nearly 80 individuals regarding this aspect of the project. And staff was able to explain to us and at the Planning Commission how they really address these concerns by clarifying the intent of the map update and providing additional information about the forthcoming improvements to the land subdivision process. So in closing, once again, I just want to emphasize that we unanimously approved this project at Planning Commission, and we appreciate that these improvements will lead to an easier path to production of smaller scale infill housing throughout our city. Thank you so much for the time to offer this recommendation.
Thank you, Chair O'Mara. Appreciate you being here and presenting the Planning Commission's recommendation. So we'll go ahead and get started with our presentation. We have a quick agenda to share and what you'll hear. We will get there. There we go. So what we have planned for today is to give you an overview of the Land Division Code update project, give a quick introduction to land divisions and share some relevant data of things that we learned along the way, share the goals and what the proposal is for the project. And then, of course, we already had our chair present, and we'll hear some public testimony. We have one person signed up. And then we hope to continue this item to July 31st for a second reading at that time. So just a little background on this. In 2002, Council passed a resolution calling for regulations to be streamlined to increase housing production. One of the projects that was initiated at that time was this project, the Land Division Code Update Project, that was specifically aimed to reduce barriers to residential land divisions. Additionally, the ORS, which is Oregon Revised Statutes, the state legislation now requires that cities offer a clear and objective standards tract for approval of all housing. The last comprehensive update to the Land Division Code was done in 2002, so that's a while ago. And this project is a pretty big update, and it streamlines the approval process, especially for smaller land division processes. This project couldn't have been done with the support and expertise of technical advisors from various bureaus. I also want to take this opportunity to thank Morgan for his leadership on this project, as he's led a whole group of people and negotiated with them so we could bring this proposal to you. As part of the public outreach, we reached out to various stakeholders, briefed neighborhood coalitions, and mailed notices to over 5,000 property owners. This next slide shows where we are in the process. As Chair O'Mara mentioned, we received a unanimous recommendation from the Planning Commission in April. These zoning code amendments, if passed by council, will go into effect on October 1st, which is when we like to have all of our codes effective on October 1st. And that will give the Portland Planning and Development staff time to get trained up and to update their forms and materials to provide information to the public for applications received after October 1st. With that, I'll pass it over to Morgan Tracy.
Well, thank you, Sandra. For the record, I'm Morgan Tracy, he, him, senior planner and project manager, senior planner with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and project manager for this project. I just want to start out by saying, while the vast majority of our housing production occurs in multi-dwelling and mixed-use zones, which tend to not need the land division process, as Sandra noted, land divisions are one of the ways to unlock the full housing potential in our single-dwelling zones, which accounts for most of the city's land area. Before we get into the project proposals, I thought I'd take a moment to first get us on the same page about what land divisions are. They are the process where one property can be split into multiple smaller lots. Each of these lots can then be owned and developed by different people. The land division serves several key functions, a real estate function, an infrastructure function, and a planning function to manage development density, encourage good site layout and connectivity, and lessen public risks. Land divisions can vary in complexity. For example, a land division could be used to split a property where there's an existing house so another house could be built on the new lot. Land divisions with only a few lots are often smaller in scope and less complex to review. Large vacant pieces of property can also be divided. These types of projects might involve building new roads, creating new utility connections, and constructing many new homes. The design of a land division is reviewed to ensure it meets the city's requirements, which help fulfill policy objectives like ensuring public facilities and services are available, lots are of a size and shape to accommodate future development, natural resources are protected, and public health and safety is safeguarded. The requirements for land divisions span multiple topic areas, including lot dimensions and density, natural hazards, utility requirements, and other subject areas. To get a sense of the land division activity, we looked at land division applications over the last 20 years, and we found that almost all land divisions are in residential zones. 73% of the land division applications were in single dwelling residential zones, which makes sense because that's the way you unlock the housing potential there. 22% were in multi-dwelling zones, with only 5% being in commercial or industrial zones. In addition, most land divisions are smaller projects. 78% of land division applications were projects that included just two or three lots. Typically, these smaller land divisions are less complex and can provide great opportunities to create infill development. As most land divisions are in residential zones proposing two or three lots, the project's focus was really on streamlining the process for these smaller residential land divisions. While larger land divisions are becoming less common, there are still areas in the city where additional lots can be created, which is more commonly the situation in East Portland, as you can see in this map. Streamlining the application process will help to ensure that land divisions remain a pathway to building new housing. So that gets us to our project proposals. And there are three main proposals for the project, including creating a set of objective standards for residential land divisions, updating the city's potential landslide hazard area map, and recalibrating the standards, thresholds, and review procedures for land divisions. And over the next few slides, I'll talk about each of these in a little more detail. So this first proposal is to provide a pathway to a set of objective standards for land divisions. Objective standards are a different way to write land use regulations that do not require any judgment from staff to determine whether they have been met. Objective standards are well-defined requirements that often rely on measurable quantities. These might include distances, measurements of area, or percentages of a feature on a site. Although objective standards offer clarity about what will be required, they can often lack the flexibility of the discretionary criteria currently used to review land divisions. There may be some circumstances where an application could not meet an objective standard, but could meet the intent of the regulation through those discretionary criteria. But as noted earlier, Oregon state law now requires that applicants for most residential development be given the option of using objective standards. The city still has the option of offering a discretionary review as an alternative. So to compare those two, just look at the example for tree preservation. Discretionary criteria might say tree preservation is maximized to the extent practicable, where an objective standard will use more quantitative measures like preserve 45% of the total tree diameter inches on the site. This proposal creates a mix and match system. For some regulations, the applicant will have a choice between the certainty of using standards or the flexibility of the criteria. Those are listed in the green rows in this table. The blue rows indicate that standards are the path offered. And in those cases, criteria were not necessary because the requirements were either technical determinations that provide other avenues for flexibility, or they've been simplified and no longer require discretion. And finally, the gray rows indicate eliminating rules for solar access and school district sign-offs. As I mentioned, most land division applications are for smaller 2 and 3 lot partitions, which often makes it impractical to comply with the solar lot criteria. When we looked at the past land division cases, in about a third of the cases, the solar requirements were superseded by other requirements like density, lot dimensions, or tree preservation. The school district sign-off requirements only apply to sites within the David Douglas School District. This requirement adds time and extra process to an application, but does not meaningfully change the outcome, and the district is supportive of removing this requirement. The second proposal is to update the city's potential landslide hazard area map. These changes will replace the current map, which was adopted in 2002, with an updated version using more accurate landslide hazard mapping data from the state. The landslide hazard map highlights areas throughout the city where there's a greater potential of a landslide occurring. Understanding where these areas are as part of the land division process is important so that they can be more closely evaluated by a geotechnical engineer, and lots and buildings can be placed in the safest parts of the site. The updated landslide risk map was prepared using factors such as hillside slope, geology, and location of previous landslides with mapping data. The proposed map uses this more precise data to better identify landslide risk areas. This will ensure that the requirement for geotechnical reports only applies to land divisions in areas that have an elevated risk potential. For the new map, the city used the most up-to-date landslide data sets from the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, also known as DOGAMI. And this is the state agency responsible for researching geologic conditions throughout the state. With these changes, some lots were added, others were removed, and all told, the changes to the map removed about a net total of 10,000 lots from the map. So let's look at an example of how this map would affect a land division. First, the potential landslide hazard area map would flag that this property has the potential for a landslide hazard. The project applicant would be required to submit a geotechnical report. The study of the property will identify the types and locations of features that could create a landslide risk on the site. If we didn't require the geotech report, the lots could possibly be configured in a way that some of them may not be suitable for development. On the other hand, with the geotech report, the layout of the land division can be designed around these hazards, ensuring that each lot has a suitable place to build. Third and final proposal includes a number of changes to recalibrate standards, thresholds, and review procedures in an effort to further streamline the process. These changes affect when certain requirements apply, like when a traffic impact study is needed. The changes will simplify or eliminate unnecessary procedures, like removing the need for a zone change to modify the boundaries of a constrained site's overlay zone following a land division. And the changes also help reduce process and costs associated with small 2 and 3 lot partitions in environmental zones. So the Planning Commission, as Mary Rain noted, has unanimously recommended that City Council adopt the recommended draft report and commentary as further legislative intent, amend Title 33 as shown in the recommended draft, and repeal the 2002 potential landslide hazard map. In addition, staff is recommending that City Council amends Section 1.01.037, granting the BPS director the authority to make specific map corrections to the constrained sites overlay zone as a result of a property reconfiguration, such as land division. And with that, I will pass it back to Commissioner Gonzalez.
Thank you. Do we have any public testimony, Keelan?
We have one person signed up. Justin Wood.
Thank you, Justin. You have 3 minutes.
Am I on now?
You are.
Okay. Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak, the commissioners, and I appreciate giving just having a few minutes here today. First off, I wanted to just commend Morgan and Sandra and the team for working on these, because I do think anything that they can do to try to make this better and more conducive to the small lot land divisions is great. I should say, my name's Justin Wood, and I'm a builder here in Portland with Fish Construction. We specialize in kind of first-time entry-level homes. We do a lot of these middle housing land divisions and first-time homebuyer properties. I also served on the governor's housing production advisory committee, and I know everything we can do at the city level to try to make this a little bit more accommodating and easier for us to do is great. While I think that this is a separate issue, and I don't want to take away from what this is, and I hope that this does pass, I would ask that we continue to keep delving into what we can do to make this better. There's still several issues. I actually worked a little bit with Commissioner Mapps's office directly on another issue that's somewhat related to this, but is one direct with the Water Bureau and issues surrounding water service and utilities on these middle housing lots and the land division process and some of the cost and complications that go into it. There are a lot of things we've done to make this whole process better, but there's still a lot of things we can do to continue to make it a lot better. My particular issue I was able to resolve, but it took quite an effort to do so. And it's one where I think that the code should be able to be changed to ultimately make it better. The Bureau of Environmental Service made this change, allowing for shared utilities via a common easement. And Bureau of Environmental Services did a great job on that. Water Bureau has been a little bit slow and a little less sticky on that to try to resolve that issue. There's also continued issues that we've faced on separately dealing with other issues like building coverage and how it relates to the floor area ratio in new construction. And then also some just issues around utilities and PBOT and whatnot. So I think I heard from Morgan the last time I spoke to him that there's an ongoing conversation specifically on how to do more middle housing and middle housing land divisions and some of the roadblocks surrounding those things. So I wanted to use this opportunity to just, to say that I think that there's more that we can do to continue to make this better for us to do more middle housing. So I appreciate the time and happy to answer any questions and happy to follow up offline if anybody has any more questions, but thank you.
Mr. Mapps?
I want to thank Mr. Wood for testifying today. And I will tell you what I think I'd like to do is talk to Donnie and Priya to get some perspective on how we can follow up on some of the concerns that Justin brought up. First, I want to say I'm delighted. Great work to the DCA in charge of infrastructure. I'm really delighted to see that you were able to work with Mr. Wood to kind of resolve some of his immediate concerns. But I think he's also voiced some concerns about or aspirations about how we could be better in this space. I haven't been tracking this on an hour-to-hour basis the way I'm sure you two have been. Can you give us an overlay of what opportunities might still be on the table, especially in the infrastructure space, to help us get better or help us remove some barriers to especially bringing on new housing?
Thank you, Commissioner Mapps. For the record, I'm Priya Dhanapal, the DCA for Public Works Service Area. And like Commissioner Mapps, this came to my attention recently, and I want to acknowledge the excellent collaboration between the two of the city service areas, Public Works and Community and Economic Development, specifically the Water Bureau and the Bureau of Planning Sustainability, for the quick response and flexibility yesterday in addressing your request, Justin. This is a great example of how our new form of government will work together moving forward. The Water Bureau plays a crucial role in servicing and maintaining over 190,000 water meters and ensuring continuous access to clean drinking water for our community. They also understand firsthand the challenges property owners may face when during disruptions to water access and the significant cost they may have in repairing service lines and properties affected by the breaks. I commit to working closely with my colleague, Donnie Oliveira, to ensure that Public Works supports his team's efforts to expand affordable housing options for all family types. And this initiative is critical in meeting both city and state goals. And we are committed to making meaningful progress in this area. During the next recap, the Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package, I will be reviewing this policy with my DCA partners and leadership. And I think it's essential we strike a balance that meets cities' building needs while ensuring the water is serviceable. So to answer Justin's response in short, we will be definitely looking into this and considering his input while we do the next evaluation.
Great. I'd love to hear from Donnie too, but I want to just circle back. And I think we just did RICAP a couple of weeks ago. So RICAP will come back in a year or sooner than that.
And Donnie Oliveira for the record. Thanks, Commissioner, for the question. So you all just adopted RECAP 10 in June. Thank you so much. Staff is working with the permitting development group to get that an effective date of October 1. And then it is in BPS's work plan to pick up RECAP for number 11, but just for context, RECAP 10 was funded by one-time funding. So we had to maneuver within the Bureau's budget to ensure that's ongoing resources. Yeah. So that was a work in progress. I feel comfortable led by Sandra that RECAP 11 will pick up this fiscal year at some point. But not just that, Justin alluded to the work that the study that Morgan was referencing around middle housing. All unlocking housing across all zones is a priority for the Bureau, not just BPS, but of course housing. As we heard earlier, there's so much housing to solve for across all income levels. It's going to require the partnership with the infrastructure bureaus as well. But to answer your question, Commissioner Mapps, there are several pathways that we're looking at to bring additional code updates, looking at smoothing out the pathways through permitting, of course, but also unlocking, as Morgan so eloquently put, the land availability for more housing. So to answer the question directly, yes, we are actively looking at different pathways.
Okay. And how about, I don't know if Justin's still on the line, and I won't call him out, but what promises, if any promises, can I make to Justin today? In terms of at least our ability, we're going to look at especially in the utility infrastructure space, we're going to look at it, and hopefully by June of next year, we will have at least given it our due diligence and maybe have an opportunity to bring something forward, maybe.
Did you start with the...
Well, I'm just introduced Morgan Tracy for the record. In our conversations with the staff from the Water Bureau yesterday, they are in the active process of developing a policy to facilitate more shared water meter services, but they haven't quite got that fully adopted yet, so they're still working on that. But I think just sort of in a longer term trajectory in terms of middle housing issues more broadly, this is a brand new process that the state introduced to us 2 years ago. So all the bureaus have had to rethink their systems and standards, and we're beta testing as we go. Sure. And one of the current projects that we're working on is developing another monitoring report for what's happening with the middle housing land divisions and middle housing part two of the residential infill project and what those obstacles are both on the supply side and demand side. So a little bit more opportunity for Justin to contribute his thoughts through that process, and we'll identify more enhancements as we go.
Great. Well, Justin, I don't know if you're still on the line. This council will remain in place for at least through the end of the year. If you have any questions about where the dialogue is at, if you don't have a direct contact with staff, you can reach out to my office and we'll try to plug you into where the conversation is at. And Justin and I also really appreciate your really constructive intervention into this space. I got one more quick intervention here and then I'll hand the floor back to President Gonzalez. The recommendations around land divisions caused my ears to perk up a little bit. It made me think about our friend and colleague, Nick Nichols, who owns the property out on Sandy Boulevard, maybe 113th. I don't know, or probably no one at this table has directly dealt with him, but certainly council offices have. Mr. Nichols testified before council about 2 weeks ago. He wanted to subdivide his property at 100 and I think he's basically 113th and Sandy. Frankly, he's been working on it for about 10 years, or he and I have had this discussion for about 10 years. I'm hopeful that some of the policy updates that we are looking at might help his particular situation. Instead of drag having you, unless someone has an immediate response to Mr. Nichols' immediate concerns, I won't ask you to intervene here, but I will ask my team. I got Jackson in the back room. Maybe we can reach out to Commissioner Rubio's office and we can see how the proposed changes that will come in place on October 1st might help Mr. Nichols resolve some of his longstanding concerns, which I do think that if Mr. Nichols could subdivide his property, he would sell it, and that would make way for some future development, which is part of the promise of what's happening here. Really glad to see all the work that's been done here, and a really great presentation on a very complex set of issues. And that's all I have, President Gonzalez.
Do we have any further public testimony?
No one signed up.
We have heard from everyone who has signed up to testify. At this time, oral and written testimony is closed. Colleagues, do we have any further questions, discussion about this proposal? Okay, unless I hear any interest in any amendments, we'll move the item to second reading.
All right. Thank you. I do want to say staff did a great job on this one. I do appreciate it, and it's great to see the city administrators collaborate so closely and so collaboratively. That is a promising development.
Lovely. The item is passed to second reading. To confirm, the oral and written record is closed. The item is continued to July 31st at 2 p.m. time certain. Keelan, does that conclude this afternoon's business?
I'd like to ask a quick clarifying question. Is this just for the second reading and the vote?
Yes.
I don't know that it's necessary to convene it to just for the vote. I think we could do it at 10:45 in the morning on the 31st.
As a time certain?
As a time certain.
Okay. So this item is continued to July 31st at 10:45, time certain.
Thank you.
The next scheduled city council meeting will be at 9:30 a.m. on Wednesday, July 31st. We are adjourned.